From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Mission District.
Fremont.
El Cerrito.
O-Town, baby.
Lake Merritt.
Temescal.
Tenderloin.
Treasure Island.
Richmond, California.
Coming up, we hear about a labor dispute at the University of California.
We need enough to, you know, buy food. And for a number of our members, that's become very, very hard.
Then we'll hear how campaigns to end sex trafficking may have unexpected consequences.
The more criminalized a sex worker is, the more risks they're going to take on.
And a San Francisco choreographer celebrates 40 years of making dance.
I've had a great life. I've been able to be an artist and in Bay Area, which is one of the most amazing places on the planet.
Stay tuned for more. Cross Currents is next. Clerical workers at the University of California went on strike across the state on Tuesday to push forward contract negotiations. They've been in talks since April, and the union says that the UC is delaying the process. KALW's economics reporter Jeremy Dalmas brings us this report from a rally at UC Berkeley.
Jackie Gross has been out in the rain for 6 hours, but she's still bubbly.
Everybody's a little waterlogged at this point.
Gross is a payroll specialist at UC Berkeley, but today she's on strike. For 24 hours on Tuesday, employees like her, who bill medical appointments, work in the financial aid office, and help with research, walked out of all 10 UCs, 5 medical centers, and at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. The main goal of what Gross calls a sympathy strike is to show solidarity with skilled trade workers at UCLA and UC San Diego, who hit an impasse with their contract negotiations with the University of California.
We've got some of our brothers down south. They're part of our union. We got to support them too, because they'll be up here supporting us. And that's the important thing.
But the clerical workers are also in the midst of their own contract negotiations. Teamsters Local 2010, their union, says that their wages have gone down by about 25% over the past 2 decades, when you adjust for cost of living. And they point to a study by the Economic Policy Institute that found over 80% of UC union employees can't afford an adequate but modest standard of living.
We love the university. We want to work here. But we also need enough to live. We also need enough to pay our bills. We need enough to, you know, buy food. And for a number of our members, that's become very, very hard.
The UC's most recent offer includes a raise of 18% over 6 years, which a UC spokesman called market competitive and consistent with increases given to other UC employees. But the union is pushing for better wages for all 12,000 of their workers. At the moment, there are no future negotiations scheduled. At UC Berkeley, this is Jeremy Dalmas for Cross Currents.
Jeremy is our economics reporter, and if you've got a story you want him to report, shoot him an email at economy@kalw.org. Today is National Human Trafficking Awareness Day, and while trafficking might seem like an issue we're all on the same side of, when it comes to how we should go about combating the problem, people don't always agree. The push to end child sex trafficking in particular has led to some unexpected conflicts. KALW's Liza Veal reports.
For the past 3 years, Alameda County has been waging a campaign against child sex trafficking. The effort was led by Alameda County District Attorney Nancy O'Malley. Here she is on a public service announcement.
Human trafficking thrives on isolation and secrecy, so we are hopeful that you can help us combat this crime.
O'Malley's a leader on this issue. She's won national awards and over $15 million in federal grants for her innovations. Her strategy involves public awareness campaigns, police training, hotlines, support services for victims, and prosecution. Her office has convicted 509 people of trafficking since 2011.
If there's somebody who, if left
on the street is going to continue to take advantage of particularly young people in the way that we see, that person needs to be removed from society.
Some say this is the attention the issue deserves. But there are critics who say it does more harm than good by entangling more people in the criminal justice system, alleged clients, trafficking victims, and sex workers alike. One criticism from sex worker advocates is that law enforcement treats everyone trading sex like a victim of trafficking, even people who are acting on their own will. You can hear this in the way District Attorney O'Malley talks about her efforts. The line between victim and sex worker gets blurry.
We're trying to provide resources for adults also who may not have been trafficked in our legal sense of the word, but were certainly exploited at a young age, to help them kind of address some of the issues for themselves.
Since 2011, O'Malley's office has connected 593 sexually exploited minors with anti-trafficking services, going to counseling, reporting to shelters, things like that. And these are young people that previously might have been sent to jail. A lot of sex worker advocates see this victim treatment as an improvement from criminal treatment, but it can still be a form of control. Youth can still be sent to jail if they fail to comply with the anti-trafficking services. District Attorney O'Malley admits that many of the people that are, quote, rescued for rehabilitation try their best to escape.
I would say that there's nothing that is going to stop a youth from leaving. Some of them have run 25 times before they finally realize that I don't want to do this anymore.
Former sex worker Kristen D'Angelo says this mistrust of anti-trafficking campaigns runs deep.
The fear is still there. It only takes one story to spread on the street like wildfire. That's how things spread there.
D'Angelo used to do street-level sex work, and now she advocates for young people caught in the trade. Her story begins in the 80s, when the massage parlors where she did business were targeted.
They begin kicking us out of the massage parlors, you know, saving us.
At the time, D'Angelo was 16 and on her own. She says she didn't have enough money to go without working for more than a few days.
So I needed somebody to get me an ID that said I was of age so I can continue working safely, right? I didn't want to end up on the street. But the opposite happened.
She says that within 48 hours of losing her place of work, she found herself meeting a man at a truck stop.
Girlfriend told me, I have a friend who can get you an ID. And I thought, oh, that sounds great. So I went and met this guy who I didn't even understand what a pimp was. And he told me, oh, I can get you this fake ID that'll be totally legitimate. You just have to work for the weekend for it, you know, to pay for it. But that's not how it works. And I didn't know that.
She says once you're involved with a pimp, it's hard to get loose.
You let somebody be nice to you for a little while, and then, you know, there are no free lunches out there.
The way she sees it, it was the crackdown on the parlors that forced her into a situation that resembled trafficking, even if she wasn't literally bought or sold. D'Angelo worked on the street on and off for 10 years. In the mid-80s, she was beaten and raped by a client. She pressed charges, but found that the law didn't serve people like her.
His attorney argued it was nothing more than petty theft because of who I was. Now, that pissed me off.
These days, attorneys probably can't get away with saying this kind of thing. But last year's revelations of widespread sexual misconduct in multiple East Bay police departments give credence to sex workers' continuing mistrust of the criminal justice system. The paradox in the current crackdown on street-level sex work is that right alongside it, there's a world of commercial sex that's only gotten freer, more mainstream, and safer. But it's not on the street. It's coordinated behind closed doors, on the internet.
My friend, so the way she described it to me was, oh yeah, you get paid to go out on the town with, like, you know, these guys.
This is Adrian. At the time of this interview, she was a UC Berkeley English major, and she didn't want to give her real name. She's describing an online service she uses to connect with men that want to pay her for sex, or maybe just a date. Adrian says it's not just a transaction. She plays a role in their lives that's
very Lolita-like. These guys who have, like, monotonous lives, like, making them feel excited.
She only sees one man at a time for a few thousand dollars a month. She says she looks for nice guys who are thinking,
I want to adore someone and take care of them.
These kinds of arrangements, called sugar babies and sugar daddies or mamas, have grown in popularity over the last 5 years. One website, sugardaddyforme.com, claims that its membership in San Francisco grew 50% faster than in any other metropolitan area, possibly because of how much wealth was created here over the same period of time. Adrian is reaping the profits without suffering the stigma.
It doesn't feel like sex work. Like, it's literally like a 21st century relationship with clearly defined lines.
For people like her, the sex industry has become more accessible, more lucrative, and less risky. But the industry has its own hierarchy. There's the sugar babies and high-end escorts, and then there's the marginalized street world. And the two spaces are policed very differently.
The more criminalized a sex worker is, the more risks they're going to take on.
Matthew Kellegrew is co-founder of Red Light Legal, a nonprofit in Oakland that provides legal support for people in the sex trade. He and co-founder Christina Dolgen say the crackdown on people buying sex on the street has meant that most mainstream clients have migrated to the internet.
Which means that the clients that are available are ones that are willing to take risks.
In other words, she says, they're people with less to lose, more likely to be reckless or violent, which is why they're seeing an increase
in instances of violence from predatory clients.
So why does anyone work on the street? A lot of times, the whole reason you get into the sex trade is because you need money tonight, meaning you don't have the time or resources necessary to access high-end clients.
So to pay for photos, professional photos, and to pay for your own website or pay to be on a website that hosts people's escort ads, to be able to afford to look like you are in the same socioeconomic class with those clients.
Dolgen says up until a few years ago, you could post and screen clients on Craigslist or a free host site called redbook.com. But law enforcement has closed those channels and the others are pay to play. Some people think of it as the gentrification of the sex trade, that the internet market comes at the expense of those who rely on the street sex trade for survival. But you could argue that there's not a big difference between what Adrian is doing on the internet and what happens on the street.
One type of conduct is criminalized, the other type of conduct is not.
And Kellegrew and Dolgen argue the people working on the street are a lot more likely to need the money and a lot more likely to go to jail for what they do. Kellegrew says we can't eliminate sex trafficking by law enforcement alone. We have to confront what he says is the core problem,
which is just poverty. It's the same problem with drug trafficking. It's the same problem with gun violence. You know what I mean? It's not like it has some independent root cause that we didn't already know about.
Of course, sex trafficking is a problem that we need to respond to. But for some sex worker advocates, the blunt force of the criminal justice system may be making it harder to solve. In Oakland, I'm Liza Veal for Cross Currents.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. These days, it's not uncommon to hear about artists being priced out of the Bay Area and forced to leave. But arts organizations surviving for 40 years in San Francisco? Now that's rare. Iconic dance troupe Dance Brigade is celebrating its four decades of intersecting art and social issues with the show Gracias a la Vida, Love in a Bitter Time. The show touches on everything from immigration to freedom of the press, all with the company's signature blend of fierce dancing, taiko drumming, and this time, a live band. KALW's Jen Chien sat down with Dance Brigade's artistic director Chrissy Kiefer to talk art, activism, and what happens next.
40 years you're celebrating this year. So take me back to the beginning of when this dance company was formed. It was a really fertile and experimental time in art, in dance, and in politics. So tell me about how Dance Brigade came to be.
Well, Dance Brigade started actually in 1975 in Eugene, Oregon, with a company called the Wallflower Order Dance Collective.
So since 1998, for almost 20 years now, you've been running Dance Mission, which is a theater, a performance space, also a rehearsal space, and a dance class mecca.
Yes.
Looking back, how did running a space and creating this kind of community center affect your artistic life and artistic practice?
Well, it exposed me to a lot of different kinds of dance from all over the world that I might not have had immediate access to, where I would have had to seek it out rather than it's within, you know, kind of my living room at this point because of all the artists that hang out in the lobby of Dance Mission. I mean, there's just a million fabulous artists that work out of Dance Mission.
And so all of these forms have made their way into your own work and your own choreography?
I would say that the taiko and the Afro-Cuban dance, the hip-hop too, because my daughter trained with Alan, actually. She mentored with Alan, and she has a style similar to his, and she brings that kind of street access dance to the work.
So you mentioned your daughter, Frederica. Mm-hmm. She now dances in your company.
Yes.
And so what's it like having your daughter now in your company?
I love it. And I actually feel like it's been an easy transition for me not to dance because I get to watch her dance.
Mm. And she's in her early 20s?
Yeah, she's like 20. She's just turned 25. Uh-huh. You know, and I think a lot of us, like I you know, other members of the company and stuff, it's painful to be dancing your whole life and then actually have to stop for whether you're injured or you're old or you don't have the energy or you need to make more money. And I didn't have to suffer that. I was actually really glad to stop dancing and really, you know, I love all the dancers that I get to work with, and she's just right there in the mix, and I rely on her, and she handles it pretty well, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, that can be hard sometimes.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Your company is multi-generational.
Yes.
It's also very multi-ethnic.
Yes.
Is that something you're also have been very conscious about in the past?
Well, it was interesting. Yes. I mean, it didn't start out that way. It started in Eugene, Oregon. You know, it was all white. We were white. We were like milkmaids. We were just like really chubby in the face, and everybody was blonde except for me. And then, you know, as we developed our politics, we realized we had to address what was happening. But that was one of the biggest arguments that we actually had, was how to integrate the group or how to do solidarity work around those kind of politics. Like, really, what's the best manifestation? And took a long time. But that's been a complete commitment for Dance Brigade. And I think that's the success of Dance Mission, actually, is the multicultural part of Dance Mission is not something that we sit around and think about. It's just there. People have a feeling of ownership in the space. Everybody makes room for everybody else, and everybody's included. And there's a huge sense of trust around just the building and the assets.
And the mixing of different cultural forms, and then also different kinds of people who are coming.
Yeah, I mean, like you have
classes.
The lesbian parents from the 70s with their 11-year-old daughters overlapping with Alan Frias, overlapping with Vogue and Tone, overlapping with, you know, the Cuban dancers. You know, there's just a lot of overlapping communities.
Your new piece that you're premiering in this 40th anniversary show, it's based on songs and music that have inspired you. It's called Gracias a la Vida, Love in a Bitter Time.
Yes.
So talk to me about the music that you've chose.
Yes.
And how it's inspired you.
So the original impulse for this work was responding to Ramon's request for his Cuba Caribe show, make a piece for me about how Cuba inspired your work. And I'm like, okay. So for me, that was the Nueva Trova, Nueva Canción from Cuba, Latin America, United States, all the protest music and songs that moved back and forth across the Americas. For me, Silvio Rodriguez out of Cuba was a phenomenon. It was a phenomenon. It's like you listen to Silvio, you watch a Van Gogh painting, they're the same kind of they capture the same kind of genius and essence about people and humanity.
And so, can you elaborate?
Well,
that
I just think
I'm sure some of our
listeners
might not have
heard.
For me,
when you look at Van Gogh at this point, you go, I see the genius. I see how he created his form and his color and his kind of world energetic field that captured something so that we all look at today. And it kind of goes like that. Well, that's how it was for me when I heard Silvio Rodriguez's music at the beginning. Every song was like, oh, yes, I see the way he nuanced his voice, the poetry, the criticisms of imperialism in this poetic way. I just felt the genius of his work, you know. So I hired a musical director, Christelle Durandi, who just moved here from New York, and she worked with an organization in a woman salsa group in New York called Coco Mama. She's got her own big career out there.
Amazing voice.
Yeah, amazing voice. Amazing. And she and Holly Near are going to sing the songs of the kind of piece that I've created, which is starts with a section from The Hemorrhage Show, which is us talking about the mission.
That's a show that you made.
Yes, last year, mm-hmm. 2 years ago. So it talks just about, my daughter starts at, I am a child of the mission, a barrio of artists, activists, and freedom-loving people. But this is no barrio anymore. We've been kicked out, kicked to the curb to make way for Googleandia. They were sorry to inconvenience us. Well, we're sorry too, because this is a revolution. And then everybody comes on stage and talks about what were the politics of the 70s and 80s that created the mission, you know, the exiles, the refugees, the solidarity movement, all of the mix of all those politics of the 70s and 80s.
And you yourself and being part of that mix
being
as
part
well.
Of that, because we actually toured all over with Grupo Raíz in that time period. There's probably 12, 13 songs that we go in and out of with dances and poetry and singing. And it's the piece that to me is the gracias a la vida part. It's the thank you for a great life. I've had a great life. I've been able to be an artist and in the Bay Area, which is one of the most amazing places on the planet, and I'm grateful.
That was Dance Brigade Artistic Director Chrissy Kiefer speaking with KALW's Jen Chien. Dance Brigade will be celebrating its 40th anniversary with the performance Gracias a la Vida, Love in a Bitter Time. That's this weekend at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. All that information is at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. That's it for our show today. The team includes Leela Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Jürgen Klemm, Olivia Henry, Angela Johnston, Jeremy Jew, Ted Muldoon, Lisa Morehouse, James Rollins, Judy Silber, Carrie Spivak, Stephen Short, and Andrew Stelzer. The show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet.
Take me out for a drive, 'cause I can't stand myself tonight.
Today's local music is by San Francisco musician Logan Magnus, who grew up in Memphis. Catch him play live this Friday night at Amnesia in San Francisco. Music starts at 9 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hena Baba.
I know just what I need, so I give up and I get me. These days the streetlights aren't even turning to green, but I won't let that come between you and me. Cause it ain't easy, but it ain't tough, and it goes fast, but I'm catching up. And I'm still learning, but I know this much, I melt like wax if you